A ringy ding ding.
I'd like to tell you that Shawshank Redemption fought the good fight.
They could launder the money, you know.
What's going on, fellow passengers? He said, looking over at his co-stars, thinking this was going to be an interesting episode. I guess I just miss my friends. Trevor, Heather, how are y'all doing on this fine day?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Williams, how are you?
Trevor didn't look like too much. Thought a stiff breeze might blow him over. Well, while narration might not work for this piece, I figure it's a nice thing to try in this one movie where it definitely took off. Folks, we're going to be talking about The Shawshank Redemption in this episode, which I am certain to mispronounce at least once. I will do my best not to say Shawshank wrong at least once, but we will definitely see what happens. Trevor, what's going on with movies before we jump right into this?
I'm curious as to how you would say something. Shawshank? What else would you say?
Well, Morgan Freeman has a lot of funny takes on it. He said one time a woman stopped him in the elevator and said, "I loved you in the Hudsucker Redemption."
The Huds.
He has a lot of fun with this on late night interviews and stuff.
Well, she's mixing up a Tim Robbins and a Morgan Freeman movie because we have the Hudsucker Proxy with Tim Robbins. So she's thinking she's got both of them right, I guess, but that's good.
Mm-hmm.
The current state of movies as we sit here in April is kind of bland. We're all just kind of waiting for the summer season to get started, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think since we last had our last recording, we did check out the Ghostbusters movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay. I don't want to say it was a disappointment, but it certainly wasn't as good as the last one. And I mean, it's certainly better than the 2016 version, but it just seemed like there was a lot of going on in that movie and not a lot of busting.
I think there was the happenings of the film definitely magnify how good Afterlife was.
Yeah, I would say so. I'd seen some critical stuff about Afterlife 2 in the run-up to Frozen Empire, and people were kind of dogging it for being essentially a rehash of the original movie, kind of a beat-for-beat remake. I mean, even the villains were the same.
Sure.
Hmm. But, and yeah, you could say some stuff about that, but I don't know. At least the second one, the Frozen Empire, wasn't a beat-for-beat remake of Ghostbusters 2. That would have been annoying.
I would have loved to hear Viggo come back. That would have been great.
Yeah, and I think Viggo's best left in 1989, where he belongs.
Yeah, well, and for me, I thought it could have been two really good movies. I thought it had a bloated cast, and because the cast was a little bloated, I think, hey, get rid of one of the classic characters to set some stakes. Like, have that bad guy come in and get rid of one of the classic Ghostbusters and set some stakes on that, and then have a second movie. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm just too Infinity War in-gamed about it now, but turning it into two movies, I think, would have been much better, because the bad guy really only was out of the box for like 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's kind of where the letdown is it was all built up and then it was over before really anything got started. Sorry for the spoilers, but we kind of run a non-spoiler free show here, so you should know that by now.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I do apologize if I just spoiled that for someone.
Me and my son went and saw the King Kong movie.
How
and
was that?
It's exactly like what you'd expect. It's this one's mostly Kong, not Godzilla. He's in it, but not for much. It's more on Godzilla, or no, more on King Kong doing his thing, and just a lot of the same stuff that we've seen in the prior movies. A lot of people that we don't care about. Like, sorry, I don't care about these people. I don't care about this Dr. Woman and her deaf adoptive daughter that can communicate with King Kong just through looking at him. I don't know. I go there to see monsters fighting each other, and they certainly do fight each other. And when
that's
it happens,
a really odd premise, by the way.
Yeah.
That is really weird.
They have been fighting with that. Trevor just described the plot struggle of pretty much every King Kong / Godzilla movie, probably for the last 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
they try to find a way to make humans interesting near monsters.
And it doesn't work.
It's not going to work. Yeah.
Cause I want to see monsters beating the crap out of each other, which you do get. And when they do that, it's pretty impressive, but overall it's kind of like, eh, I don't know. It's enjoyable, it's stupid, mindless fun. We went and saw it on the IMAX, and it was the first movie that my son had seen on the IMAX, so when he walked in and his eyes got real wide by seeing how giant the screen is, and then just hearing how loud it could get in there, you know, just the look on his face, that made it worth it. So that made it all the better. But and
That's
while it was
awesome
loud, it
movies
was
are.
Not Dune Part 2 loud,
right?
So
yeah, which was a whole other level allowed.
Mm-hmm. Which is now available to rent. And so I watched it again recently after we saw it in the theater in March. So we saw it in IMAX and it was incredible. And it's still very cool watching it at home, but it's not nearly as immersive. Right. So I'm sure I wouldn't say I was let down. It was still a really, really great movie and it's still going to be very high on my list throughout the whole year. But it was certainly far less immersive on my crappy 65-inch TV. The bottom of the screen kind of jumps and flickers, so I have to deal with that every time I watch TV now.
Oh no.
So yeah, it's kind of annoying.
Might be time for an upgrade.
Yeah, that's not a battle I'm gonna win, but oh well. Was that to make it work?
Sir, fear may hold you prisoner, but hope can set you free.
Yeah.
Now, that's, you know, right. I think the year is going to be interesting as far as movies are concerned, because it's kind of a reset on the superhero franchise, because I think both studios are kind of realizing things are oversaturated. So they're taking it easy and releasing less films to kind of reset audiences' expectations. They're both doing it. So I think the couple that they put out should be pretty good. But because of that, I think that's going to leave a vacuum for a lot of other movies to jump in.
Well, it'll make the conversation around other things more interesting, because Marvel's not going to be monopolizing the conversation. Mm-hmm. They got one movie on the schedule, and it's one of their Fox properties. It's not even really one of their MCU movies. They're roping it into it, and that's the Deadpool movie with Wolverine. So that's going to get that's going to make probably $200 million in its opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't think DC's got anything coming out, because they're starting over there. They got the Superman movie filming right now.
Yes.
Yeah. No real superhero movies this year. I'm on that fatigue just like everybody else.
I was too. I mean, there were some really like The Flash and some of those last couple movies. I just kind of felt like going through the motions. Like, oh, I'll go see it. But then, you know, just got disinterested.
Yeah. Marvel's been dead to me for a long time. I've been more superhero fatigued for a lot longer than the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The last Marvel movie I saw in the theater was the second Guardians movie.
That's been a minute.
Yeah, so that means that I did not see Infinity War or Endgame in the theaters. I saw those when they were out on rental or Disney Plus, whichever one came first, but didn't see them until there. I saw a couple maybe after that were on Disney Plus, like maybe Black Widow and maybe the Shang-Chi. I saw that one, but I haven't seen hardly any other ones, because I don't care anymore. They've lost me completely. Mm-hmm. And if they ever get back to their former glory, then cool. But if not, then I'm not going to miss it, because that'll just open up the door for other things to come out. And we got a lot of stuff lined up for the rest of the year.
Some interesting takes too, right? The Joker movie, the Joker movie with Lady Gaga. I think that's going to be a good film.
Oh yeah. Well, the last one was really good. I guess it's a superhero movie just because of how it is, or what the character is.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that movie is not a superhero movie. You know, it's a lot of people compared it to the King of Comedy, the old 80s Martin Scorsese movie with Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And I can see the comparisons on that. But this new one that's coming out looks wild, because they said that it's like a musical. So I'm looking forward to Joker and Harley Quinn singing some songs. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's more of a jukebox musical, so they don't have any like original songs.
Yeah.
They said it's going to have like 15 different versions of famous songs, so that'll be interesting to see.
So it'll be Moulin Rouge but twisted.
Yeah, well, so I was saying, just judging by the trailer and the shots that are in the trailer, if everyone said that the first one was kind of a homage to the King of Comedy in its tone and its feel, then this one to me looks more like La La Land. I'm here for it. I'll go see that one. It's October, I think, so I'm ready for it. I'll go see that for sure.
No,
it's going to be really weird.
Yeah, watch the trailer. It looks different. I don't know another word for it. It's not what I thought it would be like, but I really didn't know what to expect from musical, but it certainly looks very interesting. And you know, Joaquin's reprising a role he won an Oscar for, so I wonder if he'll be able to top that, or at least match it. Mm-hmm. And then Lady Gaga has proven that she can always deliver.
Mm-hmm. Oh sure, so she can belt it out. Yeah,
yeah, so I'm sure she's gonna be really good too. She was great in The Star Is Born. I didn't see the Gucci movie that she was in, but that one I just kind of missed. Mm-hmm. But this one is going to be quite good, I think. I got high expectations for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm intrigued, and I wouldn't usually watch a movie like that, but you've got me really interested, so I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, check it out. Watch the first one. That's quite good.
Okay.
It's not a superhero movie in that same sense. It's like a gritty crime movie, kind of. You know, it's got a real reality-based approach, which I guess was what everybody really liked about like the Dark Knight movies. But even those had like this fantasy kind of element because it was set within that superhero frame. This is just about a guy that loses his mind and as he goes crazy paints his face up, you know. So
oh dear.
I mean, it's good. I liked it, so I'm looking forward to that next one.
I also very much enjoyed it. I guess that should jump us on over into our film for this month. Heather, tell us about some of those details on the Shawshank Redemption.
Sure. So this premiered on September 13th of 1994, but it was only a limited release. Then it had a wider release on October 14th, so a month later, starring Tim Robbins, Morgan Freeman, Bob Gunton, William Sadler, Clancy Brown, Gil Bellows, Mark Rolston, James Whitmore, Jeffrey DeMunn, and Larry Brandenburg. It was directed by Frank Darabont. The music was done by Thomas Newman. This movie was directed by Frank Darabont and written by him as well, but it was based on a Stephen King novella.
A novella beautifully titled Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption.
Yep, good title.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have something that long at the movie theaters, I guess.
Oh, definitely not.
Doesn't work on the marquee.
Mm-hmm.
1994 marquees.
Gotta plan ahead. Yeah,
definitively. And this was actually Frank's, did we mention this is his first film? He would go on to do films like The Green Mile, The Majestic, and The Mist, but this was his first, to my knowledge, feature film. He did, I think I saw a short and a TV series, a TV movie, but this was his first full-length feature film.
Yeah, the other three movies you mentioned, that's it. I don't think he's directed any other movies. Green Mile, another Stephen King, and then The Majestic, which is really underrated.
Yep.
And then The Mist, another Stephen King movie, and that's it. He's done a lot of script doctoring too, or maybe not doctoring, but rewriting and stuff like that, or uncredited rewrites. I think he's got a big contribution in that he suggested, he wrote, I think, the first 25 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. Most of that stuff came from him as an uncredited rewrite. I think it was his idea, I think, that the movie should open with them landing on the beach, but in the middle of D-Day, not the first wave on the beach.
Certainly not a slow start by any means.
No. So like as they're coming on board, everything's already broken out, right? It's the war's already raging on, as opposed to them coming up on the beach all, hey, here we are. And then the bombs start going off. They're coming up and bombs are boom, blowing up. So a smart move by Darabont, because that really helps that out. But that's not, again, that's a total uncredited rewrite or uncredited contribution or whatever. He's had his hands in a lot of stuff over the years. He is also responsible for bringing The Walking Dead to TV.
Yes, I saw that.
I think he directed maybe the pilot or the first two episodes, maybe, but he's a credited producer on that show, and that was kind of him bringing that one forward.
Which I would imagine would be a pretty solid gig with independently of movies at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd like to see him directing again. He's pretty good. That's a good four-film run right there.
It definitely is. So while we're on the topic, actually, speaking of somebody who's had their hands in a lot of things, Stephen King, you would have a hard time throwing a rock without hitting a movie that Stephen King wrote some source material for. And it's funny, Heather and I were talking about it. There's a lot of horror in there, to be sure, but there's more to Stephen King than horror films. So I guess our top five would be good to talk about some Stephen King adaptations. Heather, why don't you start us off on your favorite Stephen King adaptations?
Okay. Yeah. So there are a lot of horror movies, and that is absolutely not my thing. But I did find a couple that I did not realize that he had a hand in. Hearts in Atlantis with Anthony Hopkins and Anton, I think it's Yelchin. I thought that was a really interesting one that he did. It just seems like a really sweet story, albeit a little strange, but really, really sweet in the end. Of course, Shawshank Redemption, The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Who was playing the host? Kissed everybody. Richard Dawson.
Yeah.
Richard Dawson.
Yeah. Who had no intention of ever letting him out of the game show, like ever. I guess he was good for ratings. But, and then This is an odd one, but I thought it was interesting. Mr. Harrigan's Phone. Have you heard of that one, Trevor?
Actually, no.
Donald Sutherland and Jaden Martell. So it is this odd story about like this like teenage kid, basically, who befriends this older man. And he's like, well, why do you keep coming here? And the kid's like, well, because I like hanging out with you. And he gives them an iPhone when they first come out. And basically, like, the older man dies, but he's still like texting him basically from his iPhone, like after he dies. And it's weird. But again, it's not a horror film, and I thought it was kind of interesting. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah,
I've not heard of that one. That's interesting.
Netflix film.
I thought it was. Yeah, I mean, I think that one was like from, I think it said 2021. I think.
Mm-hmm. I've got it listed as 22, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But it is based off a Stephen King novella, so much the same as what we have here.
Yeah. So there you go.
Trevor, how about your favorites?
All right. Well, I was going to say Running Man, so I'll have to pick another one because
me too.
That's a guilty pleasure movie.
Uh-huh.
I guess I guess Christopher Nolan says he doesn't have any guilty pleasures because he doesn't feel guilt about watching things that he enjoys. And I'm kind of this, I guess I'm the same way.
Yeah.
So I'm not really, I don't feel guilty about liking The Running Man, but I love The Running Man. I think it's really a lot of fun. It's just pure 80s camp.
Yep.
And they're remaking it. They've been talking about that for a long time.
I heard about that.
And they're finally getting it going. We're going to see Glenn Powell from the Top Gun Maverick is going to be in it, and Twisters later this year.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be in that one. So that's really good. I actually didn't come up with a list, so I'm kind of going to pull these off the top of my head, but let's skip The Running Man because Heather's already said it. So, and I don't want to say Shawshank either because we're talking about that. So let's do some others. I will say The Green Mile is a top one for me. I really think that is fantastic. I watched that a couple years ago, I think. It had been the first time I'd seen it since I saw it in the theaters in 1999, and it was still just as good as ever. I will say the other one that Frank Darabont did too, The Mist, is so bleak and depressing. Yes,
very bleak.
And especially the ending is really, really tough to watch, but I think that is top-notch stuff. It's really good. I don't think you can talk about Stephen King without mentioning Carrie,
because
that was one of his first books, I think, or maybe not one of his first books, but it was certainly one of maybe the first movie, the first Stephen King movie.
I believe it was
come
one
out
of his first books, actually, too. Turned down by a ton of publishers. He was getting ready to get rid of it. His wife convinced him not to, and ended up selling it.
So that's excellent. Sissy Spacek in that role. Real good. Real, real good. Early movie for John Travolta. He's got a small role in that one, too. But real good stuff. Then they remade it. They've been remade a couple times, but I guess it was remade maybe 10 years ago with Chloe Grace Moretz in the Sissy Spacek role. Not good. So the original is way better. So it's at 3, I guess. Second month in a row, I'll mention The Shining, but that's too good. Even though Stephen King kind of distanced himself from that movie. And if you read the book and the movie are very different.
Mm-hmm. Iconic film, though.
It's so iconic and it's so good. And I was talking to my nephew about it earlier today, actually, and he wants to watch it. And I was like, I'm not going to be the one to make that call for you, man. But yeah.
Yeah.
And then
I'll be the cool uncle, but not like that.
Yeah. And then I'll put this one in here not because it's good, much like my Ghost Ship last month, but not because it's good, but that is The Langoliers, which was a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Or a TV miniseries that came out in 1995, I think. And it's so cheesy. The visual effects are so terrible in that movie. But me and my sister watched it. So she would have been, 10 when that came out?
Mm-hmm.
And it scared the crap out of her. And even when the little Langoliers show up at the end of the movie, like you've been hearing about them the whole movie and they finally show up and they're just the cheesiest looking, like the most 90s TV show visual effects kind of campy nonsense. But they terrified her for whatever reason. And I still make fun of her to this day about it. But there was a lot of stuff in that movie that we kind of quoted for years. Some very quotable things or some very little things that happened in the movie that we kind of reenacted over the years that we picked up on and thought it was really humorous and really funny. But, and I always think back to that now, because whenever you get a Stephen King story that has a lot of people in it, a lot of actors or characters, maybe not so much something like Carrie or The Shining, but like even Shawshank, for example, or some of the other TV shows or movies that he's done where he's got a big ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm.
there's a lot of his characters are the same. And so you can kind of pick up on all the different like people. Like there's always, it seems like there's always like the weird girl, you know, because we had that in the Langoliers. And I think they had that in a series on HBO a couple years ago called The Outsider.
Mm-hmm.
That was really good. So there was the weird girl there. And there's like the seemingly straight edge guy that loses his freaking mind. I mean, every character trait that I see in some of these Stephen King movies with large casts, I always think back to the Langoliers and say, yeah, that's that guy in the Langoliers is this guy in this movie. So, And I haven't seen the Langoliers since it was on TV in 1995, but I have pulled up the video of the Langoliers arriving to the airport at the end of the movie and showed my sister and be like, this is what frightened you. You were scared of this. Really? Yeah. Stop showing that to me. It still scares me. It's like, how?
Aww.
How? It's literally, it looks like a piece of paper flying over the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's mine.
Those are pretty good. I'll drop. I will add Echo the Calls on The Running Man. Really, really like that film. I saw that entirely too young for all of the violence and language and stuff in that, you know, Jesse Ventura and all the other actors in that. That film is fun for me. I enjoy.
And the remake's going to be directed by Edgar Wright, which is perfect.
A like, good sign.
I cannot wait to see what he does with that story. So bring it on. I'm all for that.
I would agree. The next one I would point out is The Lawnmower Man is actually based off Stephen King. And I enjoyed that film.
Yeah, it's a
not
good
like
one.
The second one so much, but the first one was good.
Jeff Fahey, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, it's a good one.
Him and Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, that's right. Pierce Brosnan is in that one. Yeah, that's a good one.
Next one I'll point out is Misery, which is...
Oh, man. Yes. Misery's so good.
Yeah, that one will definitely mess you up. Speaking of films, yeah, go ahead.
The movie that Kathy Bates won her Oscar for was Misery.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, every time I see like two people... Every time I see a board and somebody with two legs between a board, I'm like, oh God, don't do that. Don't do that.
Here it comes.
Oh, God. Heather's making a face. She's clearly never seen that film.
Uh-uh. Sorry.
Yeah. It is about this author who gets rescued from an accident by this woman who at first it looks like she's being so kind and rescuing him and take care of him. And it turns out she's this super fan stalker and she basically holds him prisoner. And there's a scene where she basically like ties a board between his legs.
Don't go there. Don't go there.
It'll mess you up.
You just have to show her.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'll be all right.
On our
it's
first
okay.
live edition, we're going to show Heather all the films and all these scenes. Can't mention a Stephen King adaptation without talking about It. I think It was really, really good.
Now, which It, the Tim Curry one or the one that was more recent? Which
I
one do you like better?
I tend to prefer Tim Curry's version.
Yeah. That's the OG 90s. I liked the remake, the first part. Part one of the remake version was really good. But part two was not very disappointing.
Well, and both of them are interesting takes because you're talking about a 1,000-page book and turning something from a 1,000-page book into watchable TV when there is some stuff in that book that is not even close to appropriate for TV. You couldn't put on TV in any way, shape, or form several of the things from that film. I'll give one more honorable mention to Pet Sematary, which I hated as a child. In fact, I'm seeing here that it came out in 1989 when I was 5 years old, and my sister, God rest her soul, at one point locked me in her bedroom with a friend of hers and made me watch it.
No.
Oh, that's horrible. That
my
is so terrible.
Home, so I was screaming and screaming and screaming, and she locked me in there and held the door, and I had to watch all the gross stuff that happens in that film. All of it.
The remake with, I think it's Joel Edgerton, maybe, or Jason Clarke. Actually, I don't know. One of them, too. Not good. They kind of changed the ending from the book. And they did it. It was stupid. So I didn't care for that one. But the original one in the 80s is pretty, I'll say that one's fun. That's the word I'll use.
Yeah. And my top Stephen King adaptation kind of has it all. Iconic story. Great cast, ridiculous cast of great young characters, a lot of drama, a lot of tension, and a movie that honestly, in my opinion, gets way better with age. And I would love to revisit when we get this in the window. That is Stand By Me.
Oh, yes. 100%. I can't believe I forgot to mention that one.
I'm telling you, Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, Kiefer Sutherland, so much good stuff in that. In fact, I found out that the love of my life has not seen that film. We will have to rectify that. Speedily.
That's a fantastic movie.
That's what Scotty was telling me.
One that I want to give an honorable mention to? There's so many. Like, we could spend, I mean, we probably will spend half the episode talking about all the different adaptations of
several
of his work. He's an institution. He's been around forever. One that I find to be really good is a Netflix movie that came out in 2017, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Gerald's Game, which mm-hmm. upon reading what it's about, I figured, how are you going to turn this into a 100-minute movie? Because it's about a husband and wife that go up to a secluded cabin in the woods, and they are trying to just have a kind of a spicy weekend, if you know what I mean. And the wife has the husband handcuff her to the bedposts in the bed.
That usually never ends well in movies.
Yeah. So
I like how you had to end that with in movies.
Yeah. In real life, not so much, right? He's got her handcuffed there, and they're getting ready to have some fun, and then he dies of a heart attack.
Oh no!
And she is just chained up with no key or anything. So I'm kind of like, well, okay, but how are we getting a full length feature film off of that? Like, it doesn't seem like you can do much with that. But it's really good. And I was very surprised with it. And it's really good. And I shouldn't be surprised, because it's directed by Netflix's horror king right now, Mike Flanagan. I think we've mentioned him before on the podcast before. And he is excellent. And I think he's working on a couple other Stephen King adaptations now as well. And they're probably all for Netflix. But everything that he's done so far has been quite good. He also did the Shining sequel, Dr. Sleep, with Ewan McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also really good as well. So, and I just looked it up. He's doing another one. It's probably for Netflix. The Life of Chuck. IMDb says a life-affirming genre-bending story based on Stephen King's novella about three chapters in the life of an ordinary man named Charles Krantz. Certain to be excellent. You know it will be. Charles Krantz being played by Tom Hiddleston with Karen Gillian and Matthew Lillard and Jacob Tremblay and Chiwetel Ejiofor and Mark Hamill and I never pronounce this guy's name right. David Desmalchian. I don't know.
Desmalchian.
Yeah, I don't. Like you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I do. Who you're talking about?
Loaded cast. Really good. So I don't know when that's coming out, but Flanagan's name is on it. I think it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen King's name all over this film. So some interesting critical information. We have been expanding it a little bit to include not just how much money it made, but where the film's performance sat in the weekend it was released, in the year it was released, because I think that does help us in this kind of rearview movies look to give us the bigger picture. So Trevor, kind of take us through that bigger picture here on Shawshank.
Yeah, and that's the big story about Shawshank Redemption is that it was a flop.
Mm-hmm.
People don't think that they remember this movie as being an incredible movie that is like everybody's favorite movie ever, you know, but nobody went to see it in the theater. Mm-hmm. It was a straight up flop.
Yep.
It had a budget of $25 million and its total run in the theater when it first came out was $15.9 million. Mm-hmm. So that's a flop. Mm-hmm. That was good enough for the 95th most popular movie in biggest box office movie in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
So way down the list. And you know, your top movies that year were Lion King and Forrest Gump and True Lies and Santa Claus and somehow the Flintstones.
Yeah. Somehow. Like, is that movie just secretly really good? Because it keeps popping up.
No. It's not secretly really good. It's famously really bad, and we should stop talking about it.
in the theaters, and the run in the theaters, it made 10 times as much money as the Shawshank Redemption.
That is absolutely insane. That's parents wanting to make their kids happy.
Yeah.
I want to go see it.
See, that's okay. The thing. The Flintstones wasn't especially kid appropriate.
It was marketed as a kid's movie. And there's at a time when there wasn't as many movies coming out every weekend that there are now. So when the kids' movies opened, that's what you went to see. So those five movies there that I just named, I saw four of them in the theaters in 1994 when I was 11. And the only one that I didn't was True Lies for obvious reasons. But yeah, I saw all those other ones in the theaters, including the Flintstones.
Until your mom saw that scene and then said, oh, yes, you can go see it now.
Well, no, that was
back to a previous episode.
Should have been that would have been a video rental at that point. That way, okay. If they needed to fast forward through Jamie Lee's dance scene, we could have done that. But no, but we definitely did go to Forrest Gump in the theater and to sit there when Forrest Gump was in his dorm room with the girl and had no idea what was going on. So until many years later, I was like, oh, that's what happened. That's why he was sorry.
Yeah.
No clue. But yeah. Anyway, so its limited release was, as Heather said, September 13th of 1994, opened on 33 screens, and it made opening weekend $727,000 off 33 screens, which gives you that per screen average of $22,000, which was, it looks like, the most for that particular weekend. So
almost doubled, pretty much did double up second place.
Yeah.
So, and Trevor, do you have like any information about like why a film would open on such a limited like number of screens like that?
So they used to do this a lot. They called it a platform release, and it was a way that you could kind of build up anticipation. They would release it in those 33 screens, probably are New York and LA at least.
Yeah.
And they do that maybe not so much in September. Normally you'd see that in maybe December or maybe November. And they do that to kind of build up some hype. You know, they'll put it out on like four screens and everyone will go and everyone will love it. And the critics will start talking about it. And then they'll slowly expand it out until it gets to a wide release. They don't do that so much anymore because there's a lot of screens available and they'll still do it, but it doesn't seem to have that same kind of like impact. That doesn't have that same impact as it once did. But
well, information spreads entirely differently now.
Yeah, so like you'd see it where they'd release it like between Christmas and New Year's, and it would only come out in like LA so they could qualify it for the Oscars, and then it would go a little bit wider right after New Year's, and then it would be big old wide release by the end of January. So when everyone's watching the Golden Globes or hearing the Oscar nominations in January, they're like nominating these movies and it's like that movie just came out, like why is it getting an Oscar for, you know, the best movies of 1994 when it came out in 1995? It's like, well, it didn't, it came out in 94 in LA the last week of the year, and now it's just getting to you. So that's where that comes into play. For whatever reason, that's a hard concept for a lot of people to wrap their minds around, might wrap their heads around. They, you know, I had that argument, straight up argument once with a guy that I used to work with back in the day, because he called something. He said his best picture of the year it came out, was, I don't even remember. I honestly, I don't remember what he said.
That's a bad argument.
Yeah. But what the argument was the movie had done this platform release. It had come out in December and then it rolled wide in January. And he said, that's the best picture of the year. I'm like, no, that was last year, bro. And he was like, no, I saw it in January. Like, just because you saw it in January doesn't mean it's that year's movie, you know?
This would be the best picture winner of this year. But this guy in North Carolina just saw this film. So.
Like, I've been watching some older stuff recently on my own. I think we mentioned on the podcast at the end of the year when we were doing our wrap up that we didn't get to all the best pictures. Picture nominees, because there was a couple from 1993 that I hadn't seen, one of which was In the Name of the Father with Daniel Day-Lewis. Yeah. So finally watched that. It only took me 31 years to do it, but finally got to it. Excellent movie, but it's the best picture of 2024 right now, right? No, it's a 31-year-old movie. Just because you watch it this year doesn't mean that's the year it came out.
Right. Idiot. Well, The Zone of Interest was up for the Oscars this year. We didn't see it until, a month before the Oscars?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it had already been nominated for, but it didn't get here until then. But you know when everybody saw it for the first time? Was in May of last year.
Correct.
Right. And it just took that long for it to roll here. They premiered it at Cannes in France. Mm-hmm. They held it until the fall festivals in North America. And then they hold it to December, roll it out to build up some excitement. And then by the time it gets to us in January, people, nerds like me that track this stuff, are super excited about it. So that's how it works. So that is why a movie would do that, is to build excitement.
Well,
clearly it didn't work that well. Because when it did come out on its wide release, judging by this, it opened eighth, where it was grossed $2.4 million in its first weekend wide release. Although its wide release then was 944 screens, which is a lot less than. But even this, I mean, there's movies on this list that open 2,000 screens, 2,500 screens. I mean, now movies open on 3,000 or 4,000 screens. So
well, hey, this cinematic masterpiece opened on double the screens and made double the money, and that would be Warner Brothers' debuting Little Giants.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
No disrespect to that film, Rick Moranis and Ed O'Neill. Love y'all.
Well, I'm floored by this, the fact that the weekend of October 14th, 1994, Shawshank's sitting here at number 9 with 2.4 million, but that's also the opening weekend of Pulp Fiction.
Yep.
So that movie, those both essentially opened at everybody's theater on the same day. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually surprised that Pulp Fiction's open at number 1 here. I didn't know they did that. That's news to me. 9.3 million for Pulp Fiction up at number 1.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's Wes Craven's New Nightmare opening the same weekend.
Yeah, opening there. Little Giants, as you mentioned, is on there too. Even Forrest Gump sitting here at number 7 with 3.3 million.
Mm-hmm. After it had been in theaters for
in its 15th week of release.
Talk about staying power.
Yeah, 200 and by this point, 279.7 million, and it would go on to get 294.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably close to the end of its run there. Exit to Eden down here at number 8. That's a terrible movie. I think that's Rosie O'Donnell's in that.
Yep.
Oh gosh. Yeah,
that's not any good at all. And that's sitting here above Shawshank. So
mm-hmm.
So the platform release did not really do its job here. And I think some of that kind of comes into play because you end up thinking like there aren't many like prison movies. Like why would someone want to go watch a prison movie? And that's what this that's what this looks like when you see the trailer. It's like, I don't want to go see a prison movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
exactly. How depressing. What a great way to go spend your weekends.
Right.
Well, girls don't want to see prison movies.
Yeah. And there's no women in here. Is there a single female speaking role in this movie? I don't think
so. The wife.
The wife at the beginning?
The one that gets killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does she speak?
I think there's a... She does. She... Well,
okay.
If moaning counts as speaking part, I guess.
No.
So no, she does not. I don't think she speaks at all. And that is an excellent point. I hadn't considered that in the slightest.
And technically, Rita Hayworth, they show a Rita Hayworth film in the prison and mm-hmm. her speaking, her lines are heard in that. But I mean, I guess that counts.
No, that doesn't count.
Okay.
No, because she's not in the movie. That's a movie showing another movie.
Yeah. If you speak, you have to go through an audition process with the Screen Actors Guild.
Hmm.
But if you don't speak, then you are just cast as a background performer
mm-hmm.
or like a foreground thing, like the wife maybe would mm-hmm. have been in that category. They would have just picked someone off a headshot and then got to pay her a lot less than they would have had to pay her if she had even one line. So
there's at least two, maybe the same, female speaking roles. So when Brooks gets out of prison and he starts working at that grocery store, he does either from the cashier mm-hmm. or from the customer asking him to double bag the groceries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that happened, but I don't think Red spoke to the second woman in this when he got out, but I know Brooks did.
Yeah, no,
that's
you're
a
right
good
there.
Point. I forgot about that. Yeah,
so that would have been an auditioned role at right. that point. So,
but certainly not a major role in the film.
No,
any stretch of the imagination.
But yeah, so essentially, no women roles in this movie. It's all driven by men.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that does affect things in a way. So you do have that. But really, this movie didn't really pick up its steam until it got awards and it started getting nominated for awards and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we come around to January of '95, and it's up for what, 7 Oscars?
7 nominations.
Including Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about the Best Picture nominees. This was a stacked year
mm-hmm.
for Best Picture. So it was up for Best Picture. It would lose to Forrest Gump, which if you were around in 1994 and 95, then you knew that this was mostly this Oscars was more of a coronation for Forrest Gump than anything else. There was
100%.
Nothing was going to top it. Everyone knew it was going to win, and it did, and it won a lot. So that beat Forrest Gump beat this, but it was also up against Pulp Fiction
mm-hmm.
and 4 Weddings and a Funeral and Quiz Show, Robert Redford movie. So a stacked year, and yeah, didn't win anything, actually.
Nope. Wow.
Shutout
0-7. So it was up for Best Picture, lost to Forrest Gump. Morgan Freeman was up for Best Actor. I don't think it was his first nomination. No, it wouldn't have been.
No, because
it would not have been his first.
That.
He wasn't up for Glory, but Denzel was.
There was
Denzel
another one
won.
Before that too.
Well, maybe he was nominated for Unforgiven. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I don't have that list pulled up. So, but he was up for this for his role as Red. Lost to Tom Hanks for Forrest Gump. Darabont not up for Best Director, but mm-hmm. was nominated in the Adapted Screenplay category. Lost to who? Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump.
I'll come back to this one, but the other ones it was up for, it was up for best sound, which it lost to Speed. It was up for best film editing, which it lost to guess who? Forrest Gump. And then it was up for best score. Thomas Newman's score is hauntingly beautiful, but got trounced at a time when Disney was king and Disney was winning these music categories every year. So
speaking of a coronation.
Yeah. So Lion King ended up winning best score, which was written by Hans Zimmer, his first and only up on for the next 22 years or something like that. 20 years after this, it took him to win another one. The one I skipped here was it was up for best cinematography. This was Roger Deakins, who is one of the goats of cinematography. If you see his name on a poster or on the opening credits, if they still do those, his name's on there, you know you're in for a gorgeous looking movie. He's been up for 16 Oscars. This was his first, and he should have won here, but he lost to John Toll for Legends of the Fall. Hard to really discount that one. Like, I mean, that's a, also a beautiful looking movie, but nothing beats Deakins, and the cinematography in this movie is nothing short of spectacular. He should have won here. He did not. It would take him until, this was his first in 94, it would take him until 2017 to win one, his 14th nomination, and that was for Blade Runner 2049. He would then win his next one that he was up for, which would have been in 2019, and that was for 1917, the war movie, which was shot to look like one seamless take.
Stupid good.
Stupid good is right. Devastatingly beautiful cinematography. But he's done a lot of work with the Coen brothers. He was nominated for a lot of stuff with them. He did some stuff for, well, Blade Runner, and then some other Denis Villeneuve movies like Prisoners, which is another beautiful looking movie. And you think like a crime movie like that, just a crime whodunit kind of thing, is not the type of thing you think of when you think of beautiful cinematography, but trust me on that one, it is. He also did the cinematography for a movie called The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Long title.
That is a mouthful. Good gracious.
That's Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck, and one of the most stunningly filmed movies ever. Watch it and just be floored by how gorgeous that movie looks. So I can't say enough good about Roger Deakins, and he should have won here, but he did not, unfortunately. So that's that.
I'd like to tell you that Shawshank Redemption fought the good fight and triumphed once or twice. I'd like to tell you that.
I would. Let's see here. We get to our critical scores here from the Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes score of 89. Audience score of 98. That doesn't surprise me at all. It actually is a lot lower than I thought it would be. because honestly, who doesn't love this movie? A lot of people will say it's their favorite movie ever. And famously, this movie is and has been for a very long time the number one ranked movie on the IMDb top 250, ahead of movies like The Godfather and 12 Angry Men and the Lord of the Rings movies and The Dark Knight. This is number one, and it's been there for many, many, many years, and I don't think there's any chance of it falling out of that top spot. So everybody's favorite movie, pretty much. The critical consensus is it is steeped in old-fashioned storytelling and given evergreen humanity by Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins. The Shawshank Redemption chronicles the hardship of incarceration patiently enough to come by its uplift honestly. And boy, is it uplifting, right?
Sure. So. It wasn't at one point, because Heather, we were watching it on the rewatch. At one point, Heather just bumps me in the shoulder, goes, "I don't like this movie."
Yeah. What? So, okay. Well, all right. So now that you
let him have three guesses, which scene you said that on?
Yeah.
The projection room scene?
Yeah.
No. Not okay. at all. So no.
Do you know which one he's talking about?
Yeah, I know what he's talking about.
The one with the sisters.
That behind the projection room. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So I both loved and hated this movie. So, well, I mean,
tell me, when did you first see it?
First viewing. So
when did you first see it? And what did you first think of it then?
Okay. So I saw this movie the first time one weekend I came home from college, and I watched it with my parents. And, you know, I remember watching it, and by the end of it, I was like, wow, that was like surprisingly really good. And that was a long time ago. And I hadn't seen it since then. But I remembered, you know, kind of keeping it in the back of my mind of like, that was better than I ever thought it could be. And so on the rewatch, in like the first 20 minutes, right, like it's kind of depressing. And you see a guy get beat up for asking a question. And then, you know, there's the whole maggot scene in the cafeteria that made me want to vomit.
That scene was hilarious to me.
Oh, yuck. And then there is that whole storyline with the sisters, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those parts of it just kind of made me cringe and just made me like, oh gosh, why am I watching this film? But then like the real friendship that Red develops with
Andy Dufresne.
Yes, thank you. The real friendship that Andy and Red develop, like that's the part that I liked, right? Mm-hmm. Watching them kind of navigate this world together that they're in and dealing with, you know, these routines and all these things that they have to do and deal with. And I really loved, I love puzzles, and I really loved watching Andy outsmart the warden and, you know, they could launder the money, you know, and he was
through an intermediary.
Exactly. but you know, he was smart enough to set up this account and, oh, this guy, he exists, but only on paper, you know, and he had this whole plan the whole time and he got himself out. Yeah, and he didn't. And I think the fact that he really was innocent, I told Scotty, is like what makes you like the guy. Right. Like, you know, he really is innocent. And so when he outsmarts the warden, it's like, hey, you know what? He was incarcerated for 20 years of his life for a crime he didn't commit. I don't really care what he does after that. Long as it's, you know, long as he doesn't hurt anyone like for real. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed that part.
Guy, no one cares.
He had to go to prison to learn how to be a crook. Right.
Yeah, that's a really great point, is that he's clearly, you don't know it until the very end of it, that he had this whole thing planned for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when he was offered that opportunity to start laundering that stuff, he like, it was like, oh, now I can add this to my plan too. Not only am I going to escape one day, but I'm going to take this guy for every penny that he's worth.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Really good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Scotty, tell me when you first saw this and what you thought at that point.
So my first time seeing it was on cable, which I actually read that that was on purpose, because when Ted Turner bought Castle Rock Entertainment, he owned the film, and they discovered that putting it on, say, TNT, for example, was an incredibly cheap proposition because he owned the rights to the film. So it didn't cost very much to run. So that's why it ran on a ton of cable channels at one point, mm-hmm. especially Ted's. So that's where I first saw it. As a kid, I was bored, you know, and not to mention, I'm pretty sure my mom made me turn it off when the sisters started to circle.
Mm-hmm.
Because
smart woman.
Well, it's like Heather and I talked about when we watched it. If the movie has to be about hope, there has to be despair.
Yep.
If the movie's going to be about compassion, there has to be cruelty.
Yeah.
So there's things that have to happen in this film in order to create the payoff. There's got to be stakes. So yeah, something bad has to happen to Andy Dufresne. Something bad has to happen to him, and something bad has to happen to his friends. And so that part didn't really dawn on me. But then much older, obviously, as I got much older, I fully appreciated some of the tones in the film and the things you look for. Like when you're a kid, you're like, ah, maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. But when you're an adult, you're like, when are they going to tell me if he did it or not? Oh my gosh, I got to know. Like they could have hung on that even a little bit longer,
mm-hmm.
About, you know, what if you get all the way to the boat and you still don't know if he did it or
not. Nuh-uh. I don't agree with that, because that takes away a lot of his likability, right? Like once you know that he truly is innocent, then you start to feel that compassion as the viewer, right? And that's when you go, man, this really sucks for him. Like his life has been totally ruined by this. Mm-hmm. And then you really start to feel compassion for him while you're watching.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have felt compassion for a man who, in a crime of passion, shot his wife in the act of copulating with her lover?
Not nearly as much as someone who was innocently framed for it and put in prison. No.
Heck, the prosecuting attorney that was putting him away even hinted to, no, we can understand if you did it as a crime of passion.
Yeah, he did say that.
But yeah, Trevor, what about you?
We rented it. I was probably 13, maybe 14, somewhere around there, because I was not like my peers. You know, I wanted to see the movies that were critically praised.
Sure.
I didn't give a hoot about, you know, the cool action. I mean, I cared about everything, but these are the ones I really wanted to see. And so I kind of had to convince my parents that I was at 13 mature enough to handle what this movie was going to throw at me. So yeah, I saw this probably on video, seventh grade or eighth grade. I remember talking to a kid in seventh grade because he had seen it and he was talking about how good it was. And so it was probably around there sometimes, the seventh or eighth grade, probably when I saw it, 96-ish maybe, and really liked it. And especially the moment he pulls back the poster and it reveals that hole in the mm-hmm. wall. What a great moment that is. It's just completely perfect. When he throws throws that rock through there and you hear it rattling. Mm-hmm. And then and he pulls that down and you see that. And they do the flashback where they show him chipping at the wall with that and realizing how brittle the stone is.
Uh-huh.
But like even before then, if you'd been paying attention and holding the information that they'd already given you throughout the movie, you remember immediately that he was carving that in there. And then the very next scene, the first thing he asked for is Rita Hayworth.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, mm-hmm. I need to do this and I need something to cover it up with.
Yeah.
Right.
So. And you think he's just settling into being a convict, putting a picture of a girl on his wall.
Right. Yeah. And nothing in there really reveals anything other than the fact that he's like just trying to survive and mm-hmm. just make it day by day when everything he's doing has a completely calculated move to it, mm-hmm. which brings me to this because I've often wondered this too. So maybe a flaw, if you will. I don't know. Okay. Or not. I don't know. But it's the 50s rocker dude. What's it? Tommy? Is that his name?
Yes.
Yeah.
When he comes in and he's the one that says the thing about how a former cellmate of his basically confessed to the murder that Andy is in prison for.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And the first shot of Andy and Red after that is Andy's just like, this is it. Like, I can get out now.
This is my shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then he goes to the warden and the warden is like, how could you fall for such a thing? And then Andy calls him obtuse for not, you know, not wanting to help him. And yeah. then he says, you know, I promise I won't say anything that goes on here, which
what a
then
tightwad. The word obtuse sets him off.
Yeah. Obtuse is the one that sets him off and yeah. he gets thrown into solitary. And while he's down there, then the warden has Tommy murdered in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
And the warden comes down and he's like, yeah, he tried to escape, but sorry about that. How about you spend another month down here?
Mm-hmm.
So then he ends up spending another month there. And then when he comes out, that's when he has his scene with Red where he says the most memorable line in this movie, which is get busy living or get busy dying. Mm-hmm. And then it's the next night that he or it's that night that he escapes. Mm-hmm. Right. So does that mean that on the day that Tommy tells him that he's been framed and he knows who actually really did this murder, that would mean that Andy's ready to break out of prison that day,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he doesn't really have another opportunity to finish doing what he's doing.
Yes.
So maybe not a flaw, but maybe just a question. Why would you go through the whole going to the warden and begging him to find this guy and see if you can get out of jail for free, basically?
Well,
instead of just going through your plan and ripping the guy off and just riding off into the sunset with your middle finger face at him, you know?
Well, at that point, the relationship was completely symbiotic, right? Like the warden had been nothing but good to him and had theoretically been protecting him from all of the worst elements of the prison.
Maybe, but the whole laundering thing was all set up for him to rip this guy off. Because remember, he's been digging that hole for years this point.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in his mind that when I break through this wall and get out of here, I'm going to steal this guy's money.
Yeah.
And tell the press what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Because.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, so like, why go through all of that? And you know, the guy is unstable and his prison ward or his muscle in the prison, the head guard is psychotic.
Yep.
You know, why put this young kid at risk by going to the warden and trying to be like, I can get out of here for free, basically. Mm.
So not as complicated, not as calculated of a move as he had been doing for the rest of the film.
Yeah. He'd spend 20 years being very methodical of everything that he was doing. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to that point and it's just kind of like throws it all away just to get out. And I guess he wants to get out, clear his name so he can live his life.
Sure.
But
sure.
The warden could sling him right back in for money laundering, right?
Yeah. But
maybe find a way to do it without going down with him.
I would have just kept on going, you know.
Yeah.
You're
probably right.
There was no other chance for him because the movie goes from him hearing about this story from Tommy to him going into the lockup,
mm-hmm.
coming out of lockup and then leaving, right? Mm-hmm. There's no other chance. There's no other last few weeks of him chiseling through that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's out of the hole and he's gone.
Well, you could also think that Andy was being intentional about watching the weather, because you remember that one of the things that kind of covered his escape was he had that big rock piece of the wall and he was waiting for thunderclaps to crack through the pipe. And so maybe that's it. Maybe he's like, hey, my best chance to get out of here is going to be when this massive storm comes through in X number of
months. That's true. And
that fits the character more.
One thing that I tried to keep my ear out for on the rewatch is because obviously, and I've seen this movie so many times over the years, so there was no scene in this movie that I didn't remember.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was no line that was oh man, I forgot about that. Like I knew everything that was coming, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I was trying to keep my eye peeled for was I wanted to see if Tim Robbins was walking differently in the yard when he was supposedly draining his
doing the POW thing and getting rid of the dirt.
And I didn't quite see that, but one thing that I really wanted to hear, and I'm surprised it's not in there, and maybe it is and I just didn't hear it on my crappy speakers, but the night that he escapes, you're not really in Andy's cell, you're in Red's cell, and the storm is going on out there, and I was waiting to see if they had put in, buried it in the mix when they have the lightning and the thunder flash, if you could just hear the faintest ping of the rock hitting that. But it's not, I didn't hear it. That's not to say it's not buried in there somewhere, but on my speakers it didn't come through. But how cool of a little Easter egg would that have been for somebody watching it again after they know that that's coming? That'd have been cool.
That would have been really smart.
Thunderclap linger, right? Even if you had made a thunderclap linger like a step longer and thrown like a piece of a sound at the end of it. No, you're right. That would have been a heck of a move.
And I've heard too that Roger Deakins does not like the shot of Andy in the stream after he gets out with his hands.
The iconic, like in the rain, everybody.
The shot. Yeah.
Like finally.
The shot. The iconic shot of this movie. And apparently Roger Deakins doesn't like it. Like, bruh, he just created one of the.
What don't you like about it?
That's like one of the most iconic images in cinema history right there. And
Michael Jordan's going to be like, man, game 6 versus the Jazz, I hated that game. Like, that is too much. But that, I mean, again, that's another scene. And there's several scenes in this film that were copied and, you know, emulated in later times. I did want to point this out because it made me laugh. So the scene with the maggot that was referenced earlier, you know, that did almost make Heather gag. And it was pretty funny.
It was because you pretty disgusting. It,
are you going to eat that?
Yeah, you see Brooks, are you going to eat that? Gross. And you can't see the bird yet. So you don't realize, you're like, dude, the old man's going to eat the maggot. The old man's going to eat the maggot. And he pops it out. And then you see him go in his pocket and feed it to the bird. But I learned that apparently the Humane Society actually, I got Heather with this. I was like, honey, the Humane Society was apparently mad at Frank Darabont over that. Can you imagine why? And she said, well, it must have been over the bird, right? And I said, no, it was about the maggot.
Come on.
Yeah.
That is some ridiculous crap.
So they used a living maggot, obviously, for the close-ups when Andy was holding it. But for when it gets fed to the bird, they asked him to use a maggot that was already dead. And Frank said he would and didn't.
Heaven forbid.
Who cares?
Could you imagine the news story of the Humane Society suing Frank Darabont for killing a maggot to use in the scene?
Can you imagine the number of people that need new hobbies?
I'm telling you, very, very rough.
The Humane Society needs a new hobby for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that would have been one of the dumbest of dumb things to get upset about on this film. But you can't go this far in Shawshank without talking about Morgan Freeman, right? Morgan Freeman, number one, this entire new frame of his career around being this buttery smooth narrator starts in this film. Because, I mean, Trevor, can you or Heather, can y'all think of another film with this much voiceover that works? Because usually voiceover means you're forcing storytelling.
Yeah, I don't particularly like voiceover at all. Sometimes it works, most times it doesn't. And here it does. And the reason it does is because of Morgan Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, because it doesn't matter what he's saying, it's just that he's saying it, you know. And
the cadence, the tone, there's I have no idea how to technically describe it. But I did see a funny, I was looking at some of the research I did on YouTube and some of the videos, somebody comments, and I thought it was hilarious, when Morgan Freeman talks in his sleep, the whole neighborhood wakes up to listen.
That's awesome.
That's true.
So in All About Eve, I remember there being at least a little bit of voiceover from Addison DeWitt. And I mean, not nearly as much as in this film, but there was a good bit of it. And I thought it worked pretty well there.
Yeah, back in the older films, sometimes they'd have a voiceover narration that kind of opened and closed the movie. And that's just a different style of filmmaking. And now the more modern stuff that we're used to, including this, even though it's 30 years old, is that the phrase they use is show, don't tell.
Yep.
So why should you, waste your time telling something when you can show it? So usually when I'm seeing something, I don't like the narration immediately. So if I was seeing this movie for the first time as the cynical 41-year-old that I am, as soon as the narration would start, I'd be like, okay,
I'm out.
but I'd be skeptical of it, which is what happens anytime there's any kind of narration like that. But you have to earn it, you know, it's got to make sense. And sometimes there's things that don't make sense about it. Like, you know, why is this guy narrating? Or why are we now X number of minutes into the film and now the narration started? You know, why didn't it start earlier? Or started the narration. Why doesn't the narration end the movie? Like, it should be carrying it across. So I always wonder.
There's a ton of movies after that, you know? A ton of movies after that when Morgan Freeman narrates, right? Like Million Dollar Baby, like when the guy gets KO'd, something in the brain just says, time to go to sleep, young fella.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly narrates that. He's narrated other things. And I mean, it's become like a caricature of him, you know, is that he is just this kind of narrator. And people get him to read stuff.
Sure.
I saw a video. He was promoting some movie years ago, and the interviewer on the press tour handed him a piece of paper and said, can you read this? And it was lyrics to What Does the Fox Say? And so he was just like, a ring-a-ding-ding.
I must locate that now.
Yeah.
Because I can hear it in my head, and I have to know if it matches up. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no. That is hilarious.
But yeah, he's this sort of cemented that for him, but it works. And but yeah, narration, I don't particularly like it. I do, just like you said, it's a cheap way of getting a story out. We need to actually like show it to me, you know. If you can't show it to me, if you cannot show it, then okay, right?
Well, like with the scene with the sisters, the narration there makes sense because you can't show it. And you can't show that, but it's
good narration too. I wish I could tell you he put up the good fight.
Yeah, and you're also, and you're creating scope and you're creating scale, because it's not just this one moment. You're describing that this happened again and again and again and again.
Yep.
So in a way, the narration is adding depth to your scene. I do think narration goes back to ancient Greek dramas, because ancient Greek dramas, anything that happened, and we're talking way back, like, you know, back in world history type stuff, but whenever something happened in a Greek stage play, somebody came on stage and announced it.
Huh. Yeah.
It was usually most Greek play was people talking to each other. And like if someone died or something terrible happened, someone would come on stage and say, this person has died.
Yeah.
Oh, how dramatic.
Yeah. Right. It was more about the interaction of the characters than about the things that were happening. But speaking of Morgan Freeman, I mean, we're talking about what was an early chapter we had said earlier, right? Like he had been in Glory previous to this. He had been in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves previous to this. And
he'd been around for a while by the time this came out.
I might be wrong to surmise this, but I would guess we're talking about a career that was in the upper echelons of very good, but hadn't made it to legendary yet.
Mm-hmm.
Was getting there, but wasn't there yet, at least until I read this funny story that while he was filming the baseball scene, you know, anytime an actor is going to film something in a scene, they have to do it 10,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so he spent 9 hours filming a scene and basically threw a baseball in the yard for 9 hours straight, showed up the next day with his arm busted, didn't say anything.
Lovely.
Because he had to throw a baseball for 9 hours straight and didn't tell anybody.
Well, imagine having to eat for 9 hours straight.
Oh my gosh. And the same thing. Ugh.
Yeah. And pretend it's good after the 200th time of eating it.
Oh gosh, no.
Now that's acting.
So we had said that he was in Unforgiven a few years prior to this, and he's excellent in that. He was not nominated for that, actually. I just looked it up. He was nominated for Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes. Forgot about Driving Miss Daisy.
So he was there for that. And then he was nominated for something. I don't know this movie, at least offhand, called Street Smart with Christopher Reeve and Kathy Baker and Mimi Rogers. Best Supporting Actor nomination for that one. His character on IMDb is called Fast Black. So I never saw that, but apparently he was Oscar good in that one. So this would have been his third nomination, and it would be until 2005. So 10 more years before he would finally win one. And that'd be for Million Dollar Baby. You know, going back to his narration real quick, I was trying to think of narrations that don't work.
Yeah.
And he does have a narration that doesn't work, I think. And that's in Seven, because I don't think there's any narration in that entire movie until the very last scene.
Mm-hmm.
That is weird.
When he says the world is a beautiful place and it's worth fighting for. And he goes, I believe in the first part or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the actual quote, but I think that's the only voiceover narration in the whole movie. And that goes back to, it's like, why now? You know?
Kind of random. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, to
David Fincher just giving you one more little knife in the gut.
Yeah. To me, it kind of takes you out of that moment at the very end, because it's a very shocking ending. First of all, and then you have that sort of narration, and it's it. But I think we've already established that I'm much more fickle about these things than others. Like I don't like Stan Lee cameos in MCU movies because it takes me out of the illusion.
Right.
So that's obviously a very minority opinion, but same thing here probably too. I don't like that final narration in Seven because it doesn't fit, and it kind of takes you out of that shock that you're sitting there in the theater about what you just watched. Really, it's the shocking ending, and then it's over. Like they don't give
you really didn't any need chance anything to after the shocking ending, because the ending was just so much to sit on in the beginning anyway.
Yeah, and we're gonna get to Chinatown here at some point, and that one also has a pretty crazy ending. There could could be some really good room for some kind of philosophical narration at the very end. Mm-hmm. But that movie ends with an incredibly iconic line, and they could have used the same thing here. And we'll come back to that whenever we get to Chinatown. I won't go any further because I don't think either of you have seen that. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a good one to watch.
Narration at the end of American History X, I would say probably the same situation.
Yeah. Well,
that was when they read Edward Furlong's essay after.
Well, his narration was the essay, and he was writing the essay throughout the movie.
Correct.
So I think that one actually works.
That actually worked for you.
It does. And it's maybe it's a little jarring because you're hearing it and you're also seeing the dead character on the scene, you know. Sure. It's like he's dead and he's still narrating, but you know, he's not the narration there is the paper he's writing. And that's the whole purpose of the movie, is for him to write this paper pretty much. So it may not fit the moment like dialogue wise, but I don't think it's completely out of place. And I think the narration in that one actually works.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Definitely makes sense on that one. Well, one more thing on Morgan Freeman. He has an interesting theory about why the film did not do as well as they expected it to off the jump. So he explained this to a couple people. I heard him say it to, I think he was talking to Seth Meyers late night, and then he was talking to Graham Norton about it in 2017. He said that at that point, the only real marketing in films, and I'll just quote directly from him, the only real marketing a movie gets is word of mouth. If your first few audiences don't love it, it's not going to do well. The first few audiences came back and said, I just saw this great movie. It's called The Shim Sham, the Sham Sain, the Hum. He thinks the film's title was part of the problem. What are your thoughts on that?
I can see that. It's certainly strange, but maybe it's hard to fathom that now, because whenever somebody says Shawshank, the first thing you think of is a prison.
Prison. Mm-hmm.
And that's just the power of this movie and the popularity of it. But in 1995, that's not a, or 1994, that's not a a word anyone's really heard before. So everyone's kind of like the Scrimshaw Redemption, the the Slapshot Redemption, you know, like anything but it. They don't have no idea what it is. But now it's like, you can't not say Shawshank and somebody know what you're talking about. That's all you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, people just refer to this movie as that. You ever seen Shawshank?
Rap lyrics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It isn't rap lyrics. It's everywhere. And it's just Shawshank, and boom, you immediately know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You immediately hear Morgan Freeman. You immediately conjure up images of dark, gray, dank prison, you know, and power of that. But there was no reference to that point before. No one had ever heard that word.
Right. So, it had to come from somewhere.
Right. So, you know, I mean, people do that all the time when you can't remember the name of something. It's, I don't know, it's something stupid like the Scrim Shack Redemption. I don't know. It's good. But I don't remember the name.
It's an interesting point, but I would say that much like The Karate Kid, at the end of the day, the title is just a label for the film experience, so you know what movie you're going into.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the easier it is to remember, then the better it is to kind of get it out there to remind people, because that is 1995. I keep saying five. That's the Oscars were in 95.
Yeah.
1994, there was no social media. There were no cell phones. People weren't texting anybody. It was like when you saw a movie, you saw it on Friday, and then you had to go back to work on Monday to actually tell people about it. So you had to remember everything.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw this movie and damn it, I can't remember what it was called.
Part of those water something cooler redemption conversations. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably didn't bode well for it. So he's probably absolutely right that the title of this movie was a detriment to its box office success. But I mean, Cable saved it for sure. Thank you, Ted Turner, right?
Now, there's a sentence you do not expect to say very often.
Exactly.
Heather, what would you have called this film if you were not going to call it Shawshank Redemption? What would you have called it instead?
Ooh, give me a second to think about that. Hmm.
I threw a curveball at that. It's not in the show notes, but I figured
Prison Break.
What an interesting title for a show.
I don't know. I would have come up with something.
Sisters. We'll make it a rom-com. Andy and the Sisters.
Oh, no. Ew. No,
Rita,
I mean
Rita and the Pickaxe.
There you go.
I don't know.
No,
that would have been pretty funny, and people would remember that.
Well, speaking of, I was going to give you another Morgan Freeman quote on it. Morgan has told people in the follow-up, because again, this is one of those movies that you just wind up talking about on press tours for 30 years. But he calls the film a love story between two men and one of the few that he thinks gets away with it. What are your thoughts on that, either of you?
I don't know why you would have to call it a love story between two men. I mean, I really think what you're describing is a friendship, and that's okay. Like, I think it's just a friendship, and it was a really good friendship that they had, and I think that's awesome. And
you mean like philia?
Yeah, sure. But it doesn't, I mean, you don't have to put it in that context, but sure.
I don't like that either, because, you know, that's kind of a modern take, and I'm sure that quote came from something more recent. Sure. I don't think he probably said that when discussing this in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it seems like if you got two dudes or two girls in a movie, they can't just be friends. There has to be something else there. Yes. And I don't like that about modern movies. It's like people mm-hmm. can be friends.
Yep.
You mm-hmm. know, it doesn't have to be same sex either. I mean, it like mm-hmm. you could have a movie with a guy and a girl, and it's like it doesn't
have to be.
This is where
Trevor's going to talk about Lost in Translation for this episode.
Well, we could go there. Yeah. Because there's that. That's totally platonic. I mean, you could argue that the kiss at the end's a little abrupt, but I don't think it was romantic. In any kind of way. I think it was just kind of, it felt more just like, I don't know what the right word for it is, but it didn't feel romantic at mm-hmm. all. But you know, you can have these movies, like you see it all the time. It's like there's like a courtroom drama or something, and the two prosecutors are working closely together, and one's a man and one's a woman, and oh my god, will they, won't they, like mm-hmm. why does that have to be the go-to? Why does a love story have to happen in everything mm-hmm. that we do? Sure. And because these guys, you know, meet in a very awful area mm-hmm. and they're there for a number of years and they become really good friends. Do they love each other as like brothers? Sure. Right.
Yeah.
But
sure.
Loving someone as their brother and then saying it's a love story with two men, that those are two different things. A love story with two men is like Brokeback Mountain.
Right. Right. Well, and that's where maybe some more sentences of the original for context would be helpful. Because I fully think that your first mention there is what Morgan Freeman's talking about. I don't think Morgan meant that in the romantic sense.
Yeah. Like you're saying like, but it wouldn't be like, I don't know why you would phrase it like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Good point.
It's a movie about two friends.
Mm-hmm.
And their mm-hmm. bond for 20 years in the most, you know, unfortunate of places that you could possibly be. I mean, they're in a really awful area.
Very desperate environment.
Yeah.
Created more so because, again, Morgan Freeman was great, but there were some other great ones I wanted to mention for a second. Clancy Brown as the captain.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. See, I was looking at this and I was trying to think, like, because the way the Academy works now versus how they worked in 1994 is very different. And they like vote for very different things now than mm-hmm. they would have then. Of course, if this movie had come out now, what would the nominations look like? How would it fare? Would it be a Best Picture contender? Mm-hmm. Could it win today? And I think it probably could and would, maybe. But I was also looking at, like, you know, what else could it have been nominated for? And I kept going back and forth. I was like, the role that Clancy Brown plays and also the role that Bob Gunton plays,
mm-hmm.
either one I think would have landed a supporting actor in the current day.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so much in 1994, but now those are the kind of roles that I think people get nominated for.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it wouldn't have been both, it would have been one or the other, but I think both of them are at that level where they could have been positioned. If I had to pick, I'd maybe say it would probably be more of Bob Gunton,
mm-hmm.
but I could easily see either of them getting that, but not, you know, in 1994. 95, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Was Bob Gunton the warden?
The warden, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought.
And there was no room in 1994 for any of them to kind of get their way in there. That was a stacked category. Mm-hmm. That was Gary Sinise was up for Forrest Gump as Lieutenant Diane. Samuel Jackson was there for Pulp Fiction, his mm-hmm. only Oscar nomination ever. Chaz Palminteri for the Woody Allen movie, Bullets Over Broadway. Paul Scofield in Quiz Show. He's awesome, and he was great in that movie too. And then the ultimate winner of that was Martin Landau, who won as playing Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood. So there was no room for anyone else in there. That was a stacked category, and every one of them deserving to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
And same reason why Tim Robbins isn't nominated, because I think you could either do Tim Robbins or Morgan Freeman here.
Mm-hmm.
And Morgan Freeman's the one that got it, and Tim Robbins didn't. But again, a stacked category. Tom Hanks, of course, winning. Travolta was there for Pulp Fiction. Paul Newman for Nobody's Fool, one of his great forgotten roles, I think. Really, really great movie. And then Nigel Hawthorne for The Madness of King George. And if anybody's never seen that, that's a really good one to watch too. That he really plays that role very well.
other really good performers in this. And I do think you're right that maybe it's possible that that Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins just, they had more screen time than anybody. So obviously they're going to have the opportunity to kind of dominate the film. But I think this is one of those where the rest of the supporting cast does just an excellent job with that as well.
Yeah, and, I think James Whitmore is also top notch too. Oh, he's gosh, Brooks, yes. Also really, really great.
Yeah, he was really good.
Mm-hmm. I guess the one thing that I didn't quite get on the rewatch, I've seen this a bunch of times, but it's been a long time since I've actually sat down and watched the whole thing. And I thought Brooks had a slightly bigger role than he did. Mm-hmm. I thought he was in it a little bit more than he was, but even still, he's great in everything he's in. And of course, his voiceover narration where he's dictating the note that he sends to the prison is heartbreaking. So,
Yeah, it really was sad.
You know, just thinking
especially
about
when
that,
he
giving
said
a crazy theory. But go ahead.
When he said, "I just want to go home," and he was referring to the prison as home, I was like, "Oh man."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talk about real. You know, again, I don't have the personal firsthand experience of having done a hard time, but that is a very real thing, I'm sure, for people who get released after 15, 20, 30 years.
Well, I think they had said he'd been in there for like 50 years, right? That is your life at that point.
Yeah, what at that point you are getting away from some stability. But I do have kind of a crazy theory I'm cooking, but go ahead.
He even mentions that he saw a car when he was a kid, mm-hmm. and now they're everywhere. I mean, the world has changed dramatically in 50 years.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, even 50 years ago from now, that's the 70s. Somebody went in jail in the 70s and now they're coming out now and everybody's, I mean, gosh,
cell
it'd be
phones,
frightening. Cell phones and
TVs, video games.
Everyone's got a damn opinion online now. So it's like,
yeah, that too.
Everyone's pissed at each other all the time.
So here's
everyone's
my
got a podcast.
Theory, just pulling this off the top of my head. What if Brooks was the prison snitch?
The prison snitch.
Okay, so when the warden finally decides to him and Dufresne set up this relationship where he's going to protect him and Dufresne's going to do stuff for him, where does he send him?
Down to the library.
The library where
with
Brooks.
Brooks. Yeah.
Brooks's job appears all day is to grab books and hand them out. And he's using that to kind of shuttle stuff back and forth. You know the warden has to know about that.
Good point.
The warden has to know about that. The guards are still watching every time he goes around. They can still see every time he gives stuff and hands stuff out. Dufresne doesn't start to really get away with stuff until after Brooks is gone.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Again, no evidence, but you know, you start thinking to yourself, okay, well, he was down there as protection to kind of make his life easier. Well, then what did Brooks do to get sent down there? Because it can't be for good behavior, because the fresh fish treatment gets given to the good behaved ones.
Right.
They just, you know, they just get beaten up until they give up.
Interesting
like,
theory.
Like our boy Fat Ass in the early part of the film.
That's how he's credited too, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
How he's credited in the credits. Fat Ass. How would you like that? Hey, Bob, I got a great role for you here. You're going to be playing Fat Ass in the Scrimshank Redemption. Don't worry, it's one day of work. You're going to get beat up and that's it.
Apparently a younger John Favreau auditioned for that role. And I think the recommendation of the role of Fat Ass for him made him go, wait a minute, what? And apparently he said it inspired him to lose weight.
That's funny.
Well, great call from your agent. John, I just got this role, came across my desk. It's perfect for you. It's called Fat Ass. No, 1,000%. But there were some other interesting could-be castings. Brad Pitt was at one point attached to be Tommy, but Thelma and Louise came out around the same time, and it did so well that Brad dropped out to start pursuing other films because he was getting bigger at the time and he thought the role of Tommy was too small. And apparently Tom Cruise got to the point of even attending table reads for Andy Dufresne, but at this point Tom Cruise was apparently already such a big star that he dropped out because he did not like the idea of working with a first-time director.
A lot of A-listers will do that, and I think it's just arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Darabont 5 years later making Green Mile. Don't you think Tom Cruise would like to have been a part of that?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Mm-hmm. If I was Frank Darabont, I'd be like, nah.
Sorry.
I don't think so.
You're a little inexperienced in this film.
Yeah.
And kind of the last little goofy note I'll put in here. So we do live in an era now where when films are being casted, there is a lot of attention played to the demographics and the dynamics of the person being chosen. Trevor and I had a huge laugh around the time The Whale came out when people were so mad that Brendan Fraser was picked for the role and not an actual largely obese person, right? They thought the fat suit was insulting to fat people. I'm sorry. Well, obese individuals. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
I'm sorry. What was Trevor saying about everyone having an opinion online now?
Yeah, that's basically.
Right. Well, here it is.
Well, jeez. And then years later, Scarlett Johansson was cast in a film called Ghost in the Shell, and the main character was supposed to be Asian. And again, the world lost its collective mind over that. This, I think this is actually where it kind of works, because if you look at the original source material for this film, the original novella, Red is not a black man.
He's an Irishman. That's why he's named Red.
Yeah, Red is a white, red-haired Irishman, and they even joke about it in the film.
Yeah,
why do they call you Red? Why call
Maybe
you Red?
Because I'm British.
Because I'm Irish. Which was, you know, and again, no Irish accent, no nothing. So I guess maybe a polite warning to the anger community on the internet. Sometimes casting opposite of the tradition works out.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're looking for a white, red-haired Irishman and you have to put that in the role, who from that time period do you put in that role? And how much money does the Shawshank Redemption then not make?
Yeah, that's true.
Does Conan O'Brien get to play Red?
Yeah, right. I think or find an actual Irish actor, you know?
Right, yeah. That part gets me. Like, if you're talking about heritage, talking about other questions, it's obviously a nuanced conversation, but getting mad at castings on their face because it doesn't meet your idea of the stereotype. Again, I almost lost my mind over the conversation on the whale. I was like, these people need to get a life.
Right. I was like, that's acting, you know. Now it's like, you know, I don't know.
Well, and at the end of the day, the person meeting the criteria is more of a goofy little milk box fact than a serious contributor to the success of the film.
I think Morgan Freeman is perfectly cast in this role. But again, yes. I think we mentioned when we talked about Speed that, you know, had anybody else been cast in the role, then you would not have been able to unsee what you saw. So like we were talking about what, Stephen Baldwin and Halle Berry in that movie. And we're like, oh, no, that wouldn't have worked because we know that movie with Keanu and Sandra Bullock. And
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Oh, Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves.
we only know those two in there, and it's hard to imagine the other two, but if that's all we got, then it'd be like Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock. Ew, no. You know?
Right. You're right.
And so same thing here. It's like, I don't know who else could have worked as Morgan Freeman, but if it was Tom Cruise or whoever, I don't know, then yeah, it'd be like, well, shoot, I can't imagine anyone else playing Red other than Tom Cruise or whatever.
Right.
But in this case, he's perfect. And the joke about maybe it's because I'm Irish is...
That was pretty funny.
It works. Mm-hmm. And it landed perfectly. And he delivers the line really well, too. So that mm-hmm. also helps. Mm-hmm. Well,
they did give his actual character name. If you look at the credits, his last name is Redding. So they did try to make it make sense a little bit. Yeah. So
yeah, and I don't know if that was
his son. Apparently, the mugshot.
That's right. The mugshot is of Morgan Freeman's son.
Fonzo, oh wow!
His name is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So little Easter egg in there too. So
lots of good details in there. If you're gonna make a movie, it doesn't always. If you're gonna stick to the source material, I'm not the type of person that feels like it has to meet a certain criteria. If you're gonna cast somebody I wouldn't expect in a role, you're challenging me, and I get to accept it. When Heath Ledger was cast as the Dark Knight, they were like, "The 10 things I hate about you guys in the
people
Dark
hated
Knight."
It. Hated people it. Hated it. The gay cowboy? No.
Yeah, Michael Keaton in Batman. Mr. Mom is gonna be back. Man, like, yeah, this this happens. And you know, again, there's been an internet hate community before there was an internet.
People were furious on Heath Ledger, and they were like, this should be Jack Nicholson and only Jack Nicholson.
Right.
No one else can play the role. And now it's like, oh, Barry Keoghan's gonna be playing him in the Batman Part Two. No, no one can top Heath Ledger. It's like no one's asking him to.
It's a different take.
Yeah.
It's just a different take. Heath Ledger's Joker is transformational. Jack Nicholson's Joker is transformational. It's almost not fair to ask which one is better because they're in different settings.
Well, and there's some more like one of those. Can you imagine, like, no one else could have done what Heath Ledger did, but you know, they also looked at Robin Williams for that role. They also looked at Steve Carell for that role.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh wow, interesting.
Yeah, but can you imagine Steve Carell or Robin Williams doing that? They would have brought a totally different take to it, which is why Heath got it, because Heath understood it the way Nolan was looking at it. And, you know, maybe that's what it is here. It's like Morgan Freeman got this when they brought the script to him better than anybody else did. And that's why he won the role, even though he doesn't look like what Stephen King's description of him in the novella was, which is fine.
You can do all the previs you want, right? You can do all the previs camera work you want. Good performances still have to be there. I just said that to set Trevor off.
Let's not go on the previs.
Oh, no.
Trevor sent me a video on how previs cameras work, and I have not had the chance to look at it yet because he tells me it's going to turn turn me into old man yelling at Cloud, and I'm just not ready for that kind of energy
yet. It's turn you into me. You'll never look at Marvel the same way again.
I'm telling you.
Well, any of the big ones. I mean, we were watching the credits for Dune, and the previs is all over there too. Mm-hmm. So it's not just them. It's everybody's view of that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, final thoughts before we parole from Shawshank Redemption.
Or are we finally going to get paroled? Are we making that?
Yeah. We're going to go in and give the one speech where we literally do not give two craps, and that's the one that's going to get us out.
Yeah.
That I found a touch less believable. I was like, yeah, I understand he's being more authentic here, but he's still kind of talking some mad crap.
Yeah.
Rehabilitated is just a made up word.
It's like, that's something I could picture Charles Manson saying at his parole hearing.
Yeah.
That's a made up word. You see the swastika carved in my head? Like, come on.
Well, why don't you kick us off then, Scotty, your opinions upon the rewatch?
Obviously, I'm very glad that I rewatched it from when I was younger. I've decided that that's one of the great joys kind of advancing to this age of life, is you get to look at old things with new eyes. And I'm really glad I got to look at this with new eyes, because it is excellent. It is a wonderful tale of hope and compassion. And as I put in my notes, I think it is phenomenal viewing at certain times. Movies like this that are so good and so emotionally committed can be draining. So I don't think it's the kind of film that, like, let's hang out on a Friday night, watch Shawshank Redemption. But definitely something you would watch from time to time, and will probably only continue to get better with age. What do y'all think?
I thought it was a lot better on the rewatch. And it's been, 20 years since I've seen it, so I didn't remember a lot of it. But I did both love and hate this movie. Prison dramas are not really my thing, but I did legitimately enjoy many parts of it, and there were some parts of it that made me cringe. So, but all in all, kind of a timeless classic, kind of amazing film, really.
Yeah, it's all that. As somebody once said, this is the modern day It's a Wonderful Life, and if it weren't for all the things that make it R-rated, I'd say that's a very accurate description.
Sure.
It's a Wonderful Life, something you can watch all the time with anybody. And with this one, you got to make sure you got the appropriate level of maturity in the room watching it with you. But even with that, I think that's very true. They're both extremely uplifting movies, crowd pleasers. And it's no wonder that this seems to be like everybody's favorite movie. And it's number one on IMDb for a reason. It's not going anywhere for a very long time, probably. And I don't think anything's going to jump it. So it is deserving of all the praise it gets from back when it came out 30 years ago and up till today. It still holds up.
Mm-hmm. A movie that probably very well encapsulates why this podcast exists.
Correct.
You get to appreciate a film that has only gotten better. But I guess that kind of closes the book and paroles us out on The Shawshank Redemption, which I am excited to say I made it through the entire episode. No edits. Did not say the name of that prison wrong even once. But I guess that leaves us to find out what our next sentence is. Trevor, fire up the machine?
Prison sentence. All right, let's see what we got. Okay. No whammies. No whammies and stop. All right. So we've been doing this for about a year now, and we have not had a 50-year-old movie.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
So this is our first 50-year-old movie that we're going to get, and it is Blazing Saddles.
Oh, my gosh.
So, well, it's folks, older than all of us.
Talk about Blazing Saddles, because I'm ready to talk about it right now. We can do it right now. In fact, I'm going to quote you the entire film from dialogue. He said, "The sheriff is near."
Fade in and go. I'll need to rewatch this one. This has been a very, very long time since I've seen this. So, yeah, older than all of us. You're right.
Mm-hmm. It is.
We haven't done one that's been 50 years old yet. Mm-hmm. So this is this will be a treat.
A complete Mel Brooks masterclass in being funny.
Yep, I can't wait.
Well, folks, you heard it here first. We're going to be checking out Blazing Saddles in our next episode. We're so glad you chose to hang out with us and listen to us discuss this wonderful film and the great career of Morgan Freeman. Please make sure you follow us on all of our socials. Chat with us, talk to us about the films. Where do you agree? Where do you disagree? And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again next time when we look at old films with new eyes.